The Country Hour with Sally Dacus on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
Good afternoon. So glad you could join me on Tuesday's edition of The Country Hour, 12:05. Well, coming up in the program today, the CEO of the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association, Peter Skillen, maintains confidence in the APVMA, but says farmers deserve to have a review into the safety of glyphosate.
From a CFTA point of view, the safety of our members is paramount. And our members, many of our members do use this product and other products as well, and appropriate safety precautions are critically important in the workplace.
Also today, we'll be talking climate, of course. It's a subject that everyone's been talking about with the release of a new UN report warning of warming temperatures and the consequences for agriculture. The report was authored by 91 scientists and academics from 40 countries. Tasmanian farmer Brett Hall, who's a member of Farmers for Climate Action, says this isn't just yet another report.
Well, this one's quite significant because of the breadth of it and the expertise that's been involved in the creation of it. It isn't just a quickly generated report.
Well, now, though, the federal opposition is calling for a Senate inquiry into the independence of Australia's agricultural chemical regulator after Four Corners raised questions over how it's funded. The program investigated the corporate tactics of chemical company Monsanto, which produces the world's most commonly used herbicide, known as glyphosate or Roundup. But the federal government says the call for a Senate inquiry is purely political and stands by the independence of the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority. Jess Davis reports.
Even before the Four Corners program had aired, farmers were taking to social media, defending the use of glyphosate.
Post Four Corners article tomorrow, it will be critical for us as an ag industry to be on point and factual about glyphosate use. Don't get sucked into arguments with people whose beliefs in junk science and lack any understanding of ag won't change.
After watching the program, President of the National Farmers Federation, Fiona Simpson, says farmers are still convinced glyphosate is safe to use.
Look, I think it turned out to be a bit of a witch hunt, which was unfortunate because farmers are always wanting to make sure that the chemicals that they are using on farm are safe.
The program raised questions over whether Monsanto interfered or attempted to interfere with the regulator in the United States, the Environmental Protection Authority. The show also reported on internal documents that came out through discovery in court, which show that Monsanto in advance prepared a PR campaign to counter what they were expecting would be a negative decision from the World Health Organization's International Agency on Research on Cancer, or IARC, on the use of glyphosate. But Fiona Simpson says she's not concerned by those allegations.
Well, despite the very spooky title, the Monsanto Papers, I think really I'd question whether or not Monsanto is just doing what any other big company would do to defend itself and to defend its products, which have been through a proper and sound regulatory process.
The program also revealed Australia's regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, has not formally reviewed glyphosate since 1995. The regulator did a scientific evaluation of the IARC report and decided there was no reason to formally review glyphosate. Concerns have been raised about the regulator's independence because it is primarily funded by the chemical companies it regulates. Shadow Minister for Agriculture Joel Fitzgibbon has today moved for a Senate inquiry into the independence of the regulator.
There are a number of issues raised in the Four Corners program, including the relationship between the industry and the APVMA. The resourcing of the APVMA, I think, is a critical issue because there is no more important work and we need to make sure that it's got the people, the resources, the money to do its job and, of course, the independence to do its job for all the right reasons.
Is there a fundamental flaw in how our regulators are funded?
It's one of the questions we want to put to the Senate inquiry. Question has been raised, can the authority do its work independently when it's entirely dependent on the industry through its application fees for its resourcing? I think they are legitimate questions, but having said that, we would of course prefer that we work on a cost recovery basis, that the industry pays for the work our public servants do in approving those products. So it's a difficult question.
If the funding model of the regulator was changed, where would that money come from?
difficulty. If it doesn't come from the industry, it would have to come off the bottom line of the budget.
The Senate inquiry will also consider the impact of the APVMA's relocation from Canberra to Armidale, a decision made under former Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce.
And Barnaby Joyce and his friends, Malcolm Turnbull and others, have just wasted up to $60 million with the forced relocation of the APVMA, and there will be ongoing resources and additional costs associated with that relocation if it proceeds.
But the Federal Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, says an inquiry is purely political.
Well, look, I think people need to be calm. We have a competent and independent regulator through the APVMA. I'm confident in their actions in being able to make assessments.
He says there's nothing to hide.
People are sick of that. People in regional rural Australia can do the job just as good as people in metropolitan Australia. This is around decentralisation in a calm and methodical way that'll still get outcomes, that'll go to Armidale, that'll work with the university, a centre of excellence. This is pure politics. I've had a gutful of it. Let them run on with it.
David Littleproud says he's not concerned with the allegations Four Corners aired last night over Monsanto's corporate tactics.
Well, the APVMA's role is to cut through corporate tactics. I couldn't give a rat's what Monsanto do, and we'll call them out if they do the wrong thing, but the reality is if you've got a strong independent regulator, what they'll do is cut through all the corporate jargon and they'll use science, not corporate spin.
The Cancer Council of Australia yesterday called for an independent scientific review of glyphosate in Australia. National Farmers Federation, Fiona Simpson again.
At this point in time, it seems that we really need another study. However, if that's what it takes to put the community's minds at rest, if they're concerned about this issue, then certainly we need to explore that, being aware that somebody will have to fund it at the end of the day.
Fiona Simpson is the president of the National Farmers Federation. She was talking there with our reporter, Jess Davis. This is the Country Hour. It's 12 minutes past 12. Well, locally, and the CEO of the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association, Peter Skillen, maintains his confidence in the APVMA. But he says farmers deserve to have a review into the safety of glyphosate.
Well, I think there were some interesting questions raised in that show last night, and indeed on the back of the court case in America, where similar concerns and questions arise. So I guess the short answer is yes, there are some questions I believe that need to be answered.
What questions are they?
Well, primarily the questions seem to be centred around the safety of the product and also around appropriate labelling for the product. I mean, obviously, from the CFTA point of view, the safety of our members is paramount. And our members, many of our members do use this product and other products as well, and appropriate safety precautions are critically important in the workplace.
Yes, the report highlighted the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer having classified Roundup as a possible human carcinogen. In your opinion, do you think farmers and Tasmanian farmers treat Roundup with the appropriate handling given that classification?
Oh, look, I think that farmers generally treat all chemicals, irrespective of which chemical it is, carefully. We're all aware of the fact that no matter what the chemical is, even those that are meant to be benign can have serious side effects. And so you need to wear the appropriate protective gear and also use the appropriate procedures and methodologies when handling and using the product. So,
do you think they're doing that with Roundup?
Oh, look, by and large, I believe that is the case. The fact that it may or may not be a carcinogenic, I think if you're treating any chemical, and particularly this particular chemical, in an appropriate manner, you should be reasonably protected.
Have your members raised it as an issue?
No, I can't say that we've been overwhelmed with concerns around Roundup more generally. But as I say, you know, farmers are aware that chemicals, no matter what the chemical is, does require an appropriate attention to detail in terms of safety.
Do you support calls that have been made by the Cancer Council for a fully independent review of glyphosate?
Well, you're referring to the APVMA, I assume, in that question.
What the Cancer Council wants, a fully independent review. I'm not sure whether that's with the APVMA or independent of the APVMA.
Well, I'm unsure of that too, Sally, so I can't really answer that question in that context. But what I can say is the APVMA are the regulator, and I guess given the recent questions that have been raised, I would imagine that at some point they would be looking at the situation and making a decision. I note this morning that the Federal Minister has put out a media release supporting the regulator and certainly in supporting its independence.
And do you have equal confidence in the APVMA?
Well, the APVMA is the regulator and we have to be guided by the regulator's decisions in relation to this and other chemicals as well, until we see some evidence that that isn't being done in an appropriate and scientific manner. We would still support the regulator in that regard.
There was a concern raised in Four Corners that the APVMA is funded by levies from the chemical industry and that questioning whether that was truly independent. Do you share concerns about that, that it's funded by the industry that it regulates?
Yeah, look, I noted that last night and I think, you know, without being, without having a full understanding of the details, we are led to believe that those levies are in actual fact a fee for service, which seems appropriate given that the regulator is doing the testing and the like on behalf of the industry to ensure that their products are safe. So I'm not sure that, as it was portrayed last night, is completely accurate. So at this stage, yes, as I said, we support the regulator.
Just referring to a group of farmers in New South Wales, the chair of the New South Wales Farmers Walker branch, Sonia O'Keefe, says her and her fellow branch members are divided on the glyphosate debate. She says it would devastate the industry if a review led to the chemical being taken away, but agrees that there does need to be a formal independent review to clear up questions or, she says, misconceptions about a safety. Do you have any thoughts about her position?
No, not really, but I would say that, as I said before, you know, our members deal with the raft of chemicals and our members as a matter of right should know what the risks are associated with any given chemical. Now if there are questions around some of these chemicals in terms of the risks, in other words that they haven't been appropriately labelled, we would obviously be seeking that those things be redressed.
Peter Skillen is the CEO of the Tasmanian Farmers and Graziers Association, and if you'd like to read more about that story, abc.net.au/news, or if you'd like to comment, then the SMS number is 0438 922 936. It's almost 18 minutes past 12. This is the Tasmanian Country Hour. Coming up next, the other big news story of the day, and that's the UN IPCC report on climate change. Stay with us on ABC Radio and across ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
G'day, it's Costa from ABC TV's Gardening Australia. This Saturday, come and join me at the Tamar Sustainable Living Expo at Albert Hall in Launceston. I'll be there with over 30 exhibitors, plus workshop spaces all about reducing your ecological footprint and saving money at the same time. At only $5 for entry and free for kids, along with plenty of prizes to be won, it's going to be a fantastic day. See you there.
Well, Farmers for Climate Action say the IPCC report released yesterday backs their calls for a fully funded policy on climate change to support sustainable agriculture. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report was commissioned by global governments to advise them on how the world can limit global warming to 1.5 degrees and to examine the climate impacts at this level of warming. Brett Hall is a Tasmanian farmer and a member of the Cattle Council of Australia. And he says because of its scope, this report is a significant one.
Just to give it a little bit of background, it's a very well-considered report. It's been 2.5 years in the making. So there's been 91 scientists that have come from around the world, indeed 40 countries, to author the report. And they've cited 6,000 scientific references in this report. So it's very broad-reaching, and it's been reviewing what's been happening over the past few years and you know, checking to see if the modelling's been okay, and certainly seeing the impacts from about 1 degree of warming, and they've also been making projections about 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees of warming.
Let's take a look at the findings. We'll talk about your response to the report, but what are their major findings?
Well, the major findings, I suppose, the good news is that there is still time to turn things around and actually do something. The bad news is that really it's probably escalating quicker than even the modelling and that suggested. So climate change is no doubt real. It's happening now, We're experiencing that now. The human activities caused approximately 1 degree of global warming.
The report predicts the frequency of droughts to increase and the droughts becoming deeper. Are they saying how frequently they'll become?
The point that they're pressing is that there's going to be so much more variability in the climate. So we're going to see more frequent and severe droughts. We're going to see hotter heat waves and more extreme weather events. So that variability is a key challenge for farmers, because farming is a hell of a lot easier if there's a consistent environment to work in. But when it's varying so much, it makes it very difficult.
In a moment, we'll talk about what Australia's response to reducing its emissions are. But this report makes recommendations on how we should obviously manage this and reduce our emissions. Do you want to just summarise what you think the main messages are?
Well, some of the main messages are that really now we know that renewable energy, that's solar and wind, is basically the cheapest form of energy that we have. And we know that Australians need some relief from high energy prices. And these current sources, such as coal and gas, are providing high energy prices for consumers in Australia and also all the farmers out there. So we're seeing that. We also need to transition away from fossil fuels, and we really need a multi-partisan approach from our political leaders to make that happen, so that they can come together and form a national strategy on agriculture and climate change.
Brett Hall from Farmers for Climate Action. No surprises in any of this, surely?
No, well, this has been reflected in our membership from right across Australia. People are telling us these stories about how it's become more and more difficult to farm under these conditions. And certainly with such variability, that's providing a real challenge. Like, Australians are the second most innovative industry in Australia, second only behind IT. And a lot of farmers have been moving to mitigate against the effects of climate change, but some of those people are already reaching their limit. So there will unfortunately be productive farmland in Australia go out of production.
What are you specifically calling on as a result of this report?
Well, it's more of the same that we've been arguing for a long time. We've been advocating for a fully funded, implemented strategy on climate change and agriculture that will support the long-term sustainability and profitability of Australian agriculture, because under these conditions, it's going to be very difficult, and we're going to have to invest in R&D and work out some mitigation measures to be able to cope with these sort of changes.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is assuring the Australian community that Australia will meet its emission targets that are tied into the Paris Agreement. Is that enough of an assurance for you?
Well, I take no assurance from that. That's sort of probably have to give that an A for spin doctoring, because there's no evidence to support that statement. The government's own figures that were only released recently show that the trajectory is going up. Australia's creating more emissions and going in the opposite direction to where we need to go. And that's been happening for the last 3 or 4 years. So how we can say that we're going to reduce our emissions down to the 26% reduction level that we need to meet the Paris Agreement, it can't happen, because there's no strategy and there's no policy out there at the moment. So we really need to give this top priority.
It was a recent protest in Canberra that was organised by Farmers for Climate Action, which was putting this fair and square on the agenda in Canberra. Did that yield any results?
Well, it certainly created more awareness in the public and amongst the politicians, but it still hasn't resulted in any action, unfortunately. This has been an ongoing campaign, and really, I guess getting back to this report, it really just shows how we need to implement some of these recommendations and get on with...
But this is one of many reports, isn't it?
Well, this one's quite significant because of the breadth of it and the expertise that's been involved in the creation of it. It isn't just a quickly generated report. This has been monitoring what's been happening over the last few years and really just seeing how good those forecasts are, and looking at more of the impacts from what will happen with this type of climate change.
In, for example, I'm thinking about the American situation. You've got California really leading policy debate in the US. What about Tasmania? How do you see Tasmania's... I know that there is a discussion paper at the moment about Tasmania's climate change policy. Do you see that Tasmania could be a leader here? Or how well are we doing here?
Yes, I think we definitely can be a leader. The state government's currently reviewing the Climate Change Act from 2008. So they're encouraging public comment to be made until the 7th of November. So I'd really encourage people to get involved with that and have a strong voice to sort of say, you know, we want to achieve some of these recommendations that the IPCC is calling for. So,
but do you see any real measure there? Because we've got a Liberal government in Tasmania, you've got a Liberal government nationally. I mean, do you think they're on a parallel approach to climate change?
I think there's really good, I'm encouraged by the amount of really good engagement from all the political parties on climate change in Tasmania. They all collectively recognise that, and they're also mature enough to have the conversation, have the debate, and they realise that there's actually some benefit in Tasmania acting. We've got a natural advantage in our energy creation in Tasmania, and we can actually really lead the nation and show some leadership on this and be at the forefront of this change.
Do you get a sense of that from our Premier?
Yes, from the current government and the opposition and the Greens. They're all pretty much in unison of the importance of the climate in Tasmania, a clean green image, and moving forward to protect that and also be a leader in this area of climate change.
Do you have any evidence of that?
Just speaking with them, generally. Yes, we've got very good feedback with them and they've all got pretty good intent, and I'm encouraged that they'll probably work together in unison on this and put party politics aside and do what's right for the state.
But it's not likely that Tasmania would set its own emission targets and go out on its own compared to what else is happening in Australia. That would be a risky thing. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, New Zealand's already going down this road. They've committed to being carbon neutral. And certainly the Australian livestock industry is also committed to be carbon neutral by 2030. So there's already a lot of movement in this space. Tasmania's already got the advantage of having a large hydro generation, but there's huge capability to do a lot more with solar and wind power in Tasmania. There's a lot of those installations going in. We're already seeing the benefits of that. But there's a lot more. Like I think a lot of farmers in Tasmania could be self-sufficient in energy and be exporting energy. So there's an example of something we could do.
Brett Hall is a Tasmanian beef producer. He's also a member of the Farmers for Climate Action and a director of the Cattle Council of Australia. We'll have news headlines for you in 4 minutes' time. But as Brett mentioned, that farmers are indeed investing in alternative energy. Glenn Stevenson is hopeful a planned solar farm on his Wesleyvale property will bring in reliable cash flow. He told Margot Kelly it will capitalise on the natural advantages of the farm, where he currently trains racehorses.
It's the natural environment. As you see, the horses are covered by the booby-allas and they make their own little shelters in there. So it's a natural environment, and it's the best thing for them. I'm just lucky to have this, and it's like being in the family for early settlers, really, so just passed on.
How much land is there?
There's 112 acres, which used to be originally a dairy farm, but as you know, on 112 acres you can't survive a dairy farm. And then it went to a beef operation, which I run. We used to have 50 breeding cows. Same again, you can just survive. You don't make a living, you just pay the bills. And so then we've transgressed into horses, a few cattle, and hopefully shortly into solar panels.
Where's the solar farm going to go?
So that'll go just about 10 acres up there, and then up through the back of the farm, and nearly halfway to the top there'll be 60 acres of solar panels, and hopefully we can run lambs and sheep, horses, and look at a few other little things just to diversify a bit more.
Where there's solar panels, though, that country basically becomes unusable for grazing?
For grazing, but at the end of the day, you can't crop a place like this. It's not good enough ground. And yes, you can go grow grass, but you can't make money. And at the end of the day, as I said, it's a family farm, so the farm can still run as a business, still be a farm, and that my kids will be able to, you know, not have to worry about selling the family farm.
Because we're so near to prime cropping land, but this soil type is different to those red rich soils.
Exactly, it's a loamy type of soil, like it's generally just, you can't crop it, and as you just see when you drive out, you'd see the amount of I call them igloos, but Costa's things for their berries,
the polytunnels.
Yeah, the polytunnels, like they've taken over some of probably the best farming land going around.
Yeah, the land use is changing here,
and it's everything's, you know, like as you see, there's a paper mill up there which I used to work at, and a lot of people used to board mill around the corner. airport there. So it's always been a sort of an industrial type farm area as well. And you know, you've got to change. And to survive nowadays, you've got to roll with what's going on.
What's the payment like for a solar farm if you're the landowner?
The payment's very good. Let me put it this way. As I said, we run beef cattle for a lot of years. And you'd generally say if you gross 25 or 30,000, you'd out of that you clear, you'd be lucky to clear 10,000. With this, there's no input, and it's three or four times better than cattle, that's for sure.
And the land underneath the solar panels, if something changes in the future, can that go back to being grazing land?
Oh, yes, that's what it would happen. Like, at the end of the day, if they pulled up stumps, like it's written in the contract, it goes back to pasture, the same as when the 25-year contract runs up. It can be put back to pasture and back to cattle and things like that. And at the end of the day, there's still insects, there's still grass growing underneath them, and as I said, you can still run lambs underneath them.
Is it an eyesore?
Well, I've seen a fair few of them, and I don't think it is. I think it's actually, well, I think it looks better than the igloos, as I call them, the tunnels. So I don't mind. It just looks like a black sheet.
It won't have any impact on the horses, having that?
No, it'll have no impact. It'll actually, look, what it will improve, it'll improve drainage, it'll improve fencing. It actually gives you the capital to be able to improve what you've got, so, yeah.
Glenn Stevenson's is a racehorse trainer at Wesley Vale in the northwest. He was talking there with Margot Kelly. His farm is the proposed site of what would be Tasmania's largest solar farm, featuring 40,000 solar panels producing 12.5 megawatts of energy. That's enough to power almost 3,000 homes. And on Wednesday, as in tomorrow, a special country hour will be hearing why farmers around Glenn's property at Wesley Vale right through to Sassafras are mixing things up to increase on-farm revenue. That's a special program that will be jointly presented by Margot Kelly and Larissa Smith, our Northern Rural reporters. That'll be between 12 and 1 tomorrow on the Country Hour.
On ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, it's the Country Hour with Sally Dacus.
Well, we're going to have a dose of horticulture for you between now and 1 o'clock. We've got a charming story for you. Charlie Toll is doing a lot better than your average 12-year-old, mowing lawns on the weekend. He made a tidy $7,000 from a pumpkin crop on land he leased from his dad, Robbie, on the family farm at Cressy.
Yeah, so we just went along with, like, stepped out a metre, dug a little hole, put the seed in, and did that over and over again. It would take us almost 45 minutes to an hour.
And then you gradually got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, a lot bigger.
Meet Charlie Toll with a report from Larissa Smith coming up in around 10 minutes' time. We're also going to check on progress, or not so much progress, with the proposed ag visa. But now at the Bureau of Meteorology, Matthew Thomas is waiting for us. Good afternoon, Matthew.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Look, I'm off to Mildura next week. I'm taking some leave and visiting home, and I just saw on ABC News 25 degrees. In Mildura today, so I might have to pack up a few shorts. But it's warm today in Tasmania, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly isn't about the southern part of the state. We might also make close to 25 degrees in parts of the state, parts of Tasmania next week. But that's around day six or day seven. So early next week, it's going to warm up quite nicely. But we've got a cold front currently crossing Tasmania, and southerly winds about the southern part of the state, and temperatures aren't terribly warm at all. So it's only around 11 degrees in Hobart at the moment, 12 degrees in Strawn. So quite chilly about the southern parts of the state, a little bit warmer about the north with around 16 degrees at Cressy and Launceston.
Any meaningful rainfall?
Yes, look, we had a trough across Tasmania overnight. There were some showers about most of Tasmania. Heaviest falls were about the west and the northwest highlands. So there was 13 millimetres at Cradle Valley, 11 millimetres at Lake Mackenzie, and Fisher River, 8 millimetres at Savage River, 7 millimetres at Mount Reid, Strathgordon and Iris River. And the west and the northwest saw generally around 5 to 10 millimetres. Totals elsewhere were generally less than 3 millimetres, and there was nothing recorded on the Furneaux Islands. Now, since 9 a.m, we've had a front move over Tasmania, and with those southerly winds, we've seen some good falls, particularly about southeastern parts of the state. So there's been 15 millimetres reported at Tea Tree Point, 10 millimetres at Campania, 5 millimetres at Hobart Airport, and 4 millimetres at Ross and Toombs Lake. So we've seen some showers more about southeastern and eastern parts of the state, and we've had nothing reported about the northwest coast since 9 a.m.
Okay, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday?
Oh, look, for the remainder of today, we'll see the showers over the state. They'll ease and contract to the south and the east during the evening. And we'll maintain a southerly stream as a high-pressure system builds to the south of the Bight. And that high-pressure system will then slowly approach Tasmania through Wednesday. And so we'll have a southerly stream on Wednesday that will slowly ease. And we'll start off with some early showers about the east and the south, only a millimetre or two. It should contract to the east coast by dawn and clear by midday. It'll be cold inland on Wednesday morning with early frost possible. Thursday is going to be a colder morning, though, with the high-pressure system being quite close to the south of the state. Through Thursday, we'll have light winds on Thursday, a slight chance of light coastal showers, but largely it's going to be a fine day. As I said, it'll be very cold inland with morning frost, and it's highly likely that we'll have a frost warning out for Thursday morning. That will be considered tomorrow morning. On Friday, that high-pressure system will move out to the east of Tasmania. We'll maintain light winds, but they'll tend east to northeasterly through the day. And there's a slight chance of some light showers about the east coast, less than a millimetre in that, otherwise fine. And then on Saturday, the high will persist over the Tasman Sea to the east of Tasmania, and we'll have a northeast to northerly wind regime over the state, and we'll see some showers about the north of the state and pushing down the east coast as well, around 2 to 5 millimetres when they develop on Saturday.
How deep a frost do you think that will be on Thursday morning?
I think the temperatures will certainly get down below 0 degrees. I'm not sure that at the moment that they'll get down below -2 on Thursday morning, but I do think that they will get down below 0 degrees on many places, particularly the Upper Derwent Valley, the parts of the southeast, the Midlands, central north, east coast, and parts of the northwest coast.
Well, they should get a bit of rain first, perhaps, and that might mitigate some of that frost, hopefully.
There won't be terribly much on Thursday.
No.
It's the frost tomorrow won't be quite as significant, because we'll still maintain the winds and we'll have a little bit more cloud about the south and the east of the state, and the slight chance of some showers as well. And with the southerly flow, the winds through the northern Midlands and down the through the central north will be a moderate southeasterly, so it shouldn't be likely that a heavy frost will form overnight tonight.
Thank you. Now, just looking out to sea then.
Okay, so with those southerly winds pushing in, we've got southeast to southwesterly winds of 20 to 30 knots about the south and the west of the state at the moment, and they'll extend to eastern waters during the afternoon and to northern waters by evening. Currently, we've got northwesterly to southwesterly winds of 5 to 15 knots about eastern and northern waters ahead of that change. Into tomorrow, we'll have south to southeasterly winds starting off around 20 to 30 knots and easing back to 10 to 20 knots about the south, the west and the north during the morning, and then easing about the east in the afternoon. And the winds in the north should tend easterly from about mid-afternoon onwards. In terms of the swells, about the west and the south, with southwesterly swell of 2 to 2.5 metres, which should build up to 2.5 to 3 metres this evening and maintain a south to southwesterly swell near 3 metres through tomorrow. About the north, we've got a confused swell below 1 metre, northeasterly component of around 1 metre and a westerly component of below 0.5 metre. About the east, there's a southerly near 1 metre that should build to 1.5 to 2.5 metres during this evening and maintain that through tomorrow. And we'll also got an east to northeasterly of 1 to 1.5 metres, which should decay below 1 metre through tomorrow.
And quickly, can we wrap up the... Oh, you're going to do the observations? We might just sneak in the warnings as well quickly.
Yep, and the wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel shows a significant wave of 2.3 metres, a maximum wave of 3.7 metres in a 13-second period. And the warnings, we have a strong wind warning for all Tasmanian coastal waters for today, including all southeast inshore waters. For tomorrow, that strong wind warning contracts to northern and eastern coastal waters from Sandy Cape to Tasman Island.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
No worries. Bye.
Matthew Thomas at the Bureau of Meteorology.
This is the Country Hour with Sally Dacus on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
Well, farmers want a specialised agriculture visa now to deal with what they describe as a crippling shortage of workers during the harvest. It's something the federal government has said it will deliver by the end of the year. But the rushed political process has raised concerns that what will be delivered will be half-baked. Clint Jesper has more.
Every year, Northern Territory mango farmer Ian Quinn is faced with the daunting task of increasing his workforce by tenfold. And that's before the intense harvest period even starts.
What happens if we can't get any workers? There will be fruit on the ground. Yes, most definitely. It's happened to many, many growers in Australia, particularly mango growers, because we've got a very short tropical season and a few other difficulties. But it certainly happens to our colleagues in the southern vegetable industry just as much.
It's why Ian Quinn, like many others, wants a specialised agricultural visa.
We think an ag visa will broaden our catchment area for people and simplify the process of getting people back so we can get suitable returning workers coming back on a simple, mutually workable basis year on year on year.
Farmers already have options for bringing in skilled and unskilled labour. There's backpackers seeking to extend their stay another year, or there's the Seasonal Workers Program, which allows workers from the Pacific Islands to work on farms. At the moment, neither are working for Ian Quinn.
We've applied for the Seasonal Workers Program a number of times, and we didn't know we were going to get our returning staff till 3 weeks before we needed them. So nothing can be more hopeless than that now, can it? We applied many times before we got approval, as have our colleagues applied many more times than us and still haven't got approval. So how can you say that's a good program?
His frustrations are shared by Victorian lettuce producer Andrew Bulmer.
We're a big advocate for the Seasonal Pacific Labour Program, and we think that's a good program, but we would like the ag visa so we could tap into more people from potentially different regions as well. We actively employ as many local people as we can. You know, we're very strong for local employment. We put on traineeships and apprenticeships for young people locally as well. But we find where we are located geographically that it's always a challenge to get people here in the business.
In late August, the National Party promised to deliver the agricultural visa within a matter of weeks. But the proposal raised serious concerns among senior Liberals about its potential to disrupt the seasonal workers program. Talk of an agricultural visa has already angered several Pacific Island governments and created a diplomatic headache for the government. But it remains committed to delivering the visa.
I guess my concerns are that at this stage we haven't seen wide and detailed consultation with industry.
South Australian citrus farmer Ben Cant is the CEO of Citrus Australia. He's seriously concerned the ag visa is being rushed.
So I'm concerned that something will be released half-baked. We need to have good industry consultation so we don't ruin one program to initiate another.
The Australian National University's Stephen Howes told the ABC's Pacific Beat a new visa isn't needed, and some modifications to the seasonal workers program should be considered before a new visa is introduced.
So it's the same issue that you know, we already have a number of visas. What is it? What is the gap that a new agricultural visa is meant to fill? That's as unclear now as it was when the issue first arose.
The government hasn't provided any detail on the scheme, but farmers have some views. Ian Quinn.
I would like the ag visa to be exactly as the National Party passed the resolution, available to all able-bodied persons from any country on a renewable basis. And personally, like it run through one government department, not three, and be run on a postcode basis, and be to approved employers. I think that's quite important because you hear so many horror stories in the media. And also the ag visa would get rid of a lot of the people trafficking that are coming in illegally.
The way I see it is that potentially the host business sponsors those people in for a period of time. We would like people here for a minimum of 3 years. That way we can train them properly. We know they're here, they're tied to the business in the regional area. We can get a good body of work done in that period of time, and we can have good business continuity, and that has massive flow-on effects for the local economy.
Any real detail about the visa remains unclear, aside from the Prime Minister Scott Morrison saying it'll be tightly regulated and delivered by the end of the year.
Clint Jesper with that report on the push for a specialised agriculture visa in time for the coming harvest. 13 to 1, this is the Tasmanian Country Hour. Sally Dacus with you today. Well, did you ever come up with a scheme to earn pocket money as a kid? Well, 12-year-old Charlie Toll is pulling in more than just loose change on the family farm at Cressy. He made a few $1,000s growing pumpkins this year and plans to grow more crops under his dad's supervision next season. Larissa Smith has this story.
Well, I think there was some...
At Greenvale, paddocks are being prepared for the next season's summer crops.
All right, Charlie, if you just want to drive down there to the gate and open that up and we'll go on through down there and check some paddocks.
Yep. And being school holidays, farmer Rob Toll has an extra helper to get things done.
We'll close that one, Charlie. Charlie, we're in a paddock of grass here. We're going to cut for silage, and we've been irrigating pretty steady over the last few weeks, and we're still a good fortnight off seed head emergence here.
Yeah.
So I would say on within a couple of weeks we'll cut this into silage.
Charlie Toll, who's in grade 6, has taken a keen interest in farming to the point where he's now leasing 1.5 hectares from his dad to grow vegetables.
Charlie wanted to earn some pocket money. This is nearly 6 years ago, and he came up with the idea of growing a few pumpkins in the vegetable garden, and that's where it started. And then I think the following year he had a little patch under beside the sea potato crop underneath an irrigator, and I think he did that for 2 years, and I think he had 350-odd pumpkins in 1 year and sold them at some farmer markets in Hobart, and just friends and family, and it sort of snowballed from there to a hectare and a half last year with nearly 30 tonnes of pumpkins that we harvested.
So tell me how you planted perhaps some of your earlier crops. Was it all by hand?
Yeah, so we just went along with, like, stepped down a metre, dug a little hole, put the seed in, and did that over and over again. It would take us almost 45 minutes to an hour.
And then you gradually got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, a lot bigger, 30 tonne bigger. So we had a tractor and a seeder pulled behind it. I thought maybe, if I'm lucky, 15 tonne maybe, that'd be good. But yeah, double that.
So what was harvest like?
Yeah, a lot of work. But yeah, we had seven or more people out there at one time just picking away. We'd put them all in heaps and came behind with a tractor and a bus and a basket. One time we got a ride home in the basket anyway, so that was good.
The labour, where did that come from, Rob?
All sorts, neighbours, good friends, shearers. They ended up knocking off early a couple of days and going around and picking some pumpkins for us. And it's always amazing when you put an incentive of a few beers on afterwards at the end of the day, how many people you get.
And you kept a spreadsheet the whole time?
Yeah, I did. So I started off and then we just recorded what we're doing, so ground prep and spraying and seeding and how much seed we got and, yeah, rates per hour on how we were working. So then I had some goal to pay back, something to pay back.
And who were you paying back?
Well, I was paying back Dad, mostly, for all the, for the gear, and then the labourers as well, but we paid them in, dinner and stuff like that, so it didn't cost me too much.
I think you got off lightly.
Yeah, I probably did. This year will be a bit harder, I reckon. Yeah, probably cut down, give me greater costs. So, yeah, probably maybe a little less profit, but still good.
When you planted the pumpkin crop, did you have any idea of how you would sell it or who you would sell it to?
So I already had a buyer. It's Backyard Bounty in Hobart. They do seasonal vegetable boxes. So 1 year at Farmers Market, they came and asked me for 200 pumpkins. I'm like, whoa, that's a big order. But yeah, we supplied them with that. And then, yeah, we've given them more every year. But then I ended up selling them to Hill Street, Longford, Latrobe and Devonport. And also Young's Veggie Shed in town. And Yol Green Grocer in Charles Street, Launceston.
So you hit the phones and worked out how you would get rid of these pumpkins after doubling your output.
Yeah, it took a bit. About every 2 weeks she'll doing an order. Yeah, but then someone from the mainland undercut me in Hill Street, so been unlucky.
Tough lesson to learn. This is the business of agriculture, Robbie.
Oh, yes, never smooth sailing. But anyway, you never let them get you down, and we'll get up and go again. And, anyway, still done very well. Sold a lot of pumpkins, and to start off like that, it's a credit to him, and it's been fantastic.
How much money did you make?
Oh, if I didn't spend any, about seven grand, sorry.
And what are you putting that money towards with what you'd like to do outside the farm but also on the farm for this coming season?
So, yeah, some will definitely go towards leasing the ground and seed, but I also would like to become a pilot, so then some of the money will go towards, yeah, become a pilot, and then I'll probably save a bit to keep me going.
How are you working with Charlie on the farm this year?
Oh, no, he's all keen to go again, and he's going to sow some of this area going to manage that area of hemp for me. Obviously, he's got to pay his lease fees and the seed costs and all other running costs, irrigation. So that's his project this year, but he's still going to put a little area of pumpkins in just to supply the regular guys that looked after him over the last few years, just to keep his hand in anyway.
What have you learnt about having this 1.5 hectares?
It's hard work.
Farming's hard.
Yeah, definitely. I can see why Dad comes home sore and tired. Yeah, it's been a lot of work for me and the labourers and Dad and all that, trying to organise it, get rid of it and keep it stored and just look after it.
And what have you learnt?
There's a lot of work in pumpkins. Oh, no, it's always good to try something different, you know, and it's been an interesting exercise. You know, I've learnt a lot myself, just not in agronomy work, but also in marketing and dealing with that vegetable industry. And, I take my hat off to everyone that is, because it's a cutthroat industry and you're dealing with a fresh product, and there's a lot of work goes into it. It's the best way to learn. You know, there's only so much you can learn out of a textbook, and your best experience is hands-on. And to do it from a young age, and I was lucky enough to do it with my father. You know, I grew up doing this, and I'm still doing it, and I'm still learning, and I still love it. And to be able to pass that on to my children, to be able to start, you know, at a young age and live and learn. And, you know, if they want to take agriculture on as a career later on, well, they've had the grounding to it. If they wish to do something else, well, hopefully what they've learned here carries on and helps them through the rest of their career, which they may wish to take on.
What do your friends think?
They're like, wow, you've made that much. And then, yeah, I think they earn a bit from helping out on their farms. But, yeah, they're surprised in how much I really make and the numbers. Yeah, I'm definitely really lucky.
12-year-old farming entrepreneur Charlie Toll with his dad, Robbie, at Cressy, ending that report from Larissa Smith. That's really one way to learn by experience, isn't it? And I think as a kid I tried growing, picking olives. That takes a long time with not a lot of reward. But there you go. That's one way to start. You're with ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, and this is the Country Hour. Well, the International Seed Vault in Norway, which holds samples of seeds from around the globe, has highlighted the threats to food security by genetic loss. Well, here in Tasmania, the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens is doing their bit to protecting our genetic diversity by holding a 600-strong seed vault of tomatoes. Later this month, the gardens will be celebrating their bicentenary when they unveil 200 different tomato plants in their annual spring sale. Margot White from the gardens showed me around the greenhouse.
Right, okay, so we got Banksia Queen. I quite like Arkansas Traveller. Big Rainbow, Black from Tula, Black Crim is a really good black tomato, a bit different. Cherokee Purple, really nice one. Gardener's Delight is a lovely cherry. My dad used to grow that, so it keeps coming up in his garden. So, and Sunrise Bumblebee, that sounds pretty cool.
Margot, we're standing in the greenhouse here at the Botanical Gardens. It's something like an arc of tomatoes, isn't it? Can you pick the differences in the genotypes of these tomatoes?
Well, it's quite interesting. If we just have a look here, there's potato leaf tomatoes compared to the regular leaf. Potato sort of indicates that it's a cold-tolerant tomato, and it might have been growing in Russia or somewhere like that originally. So they stand out. And then there's other ones that are quite fine, finer leafed, and the dwarf tomatoes that you put in a pot and you don't need to stake, they look quite different again in the seedling stage.
Now, we know globally there's been a huge emphasis on seed diversity, and we've got the seed vaults in Norway, is it?
Yep.
How promiscuous are they? How hard is it for the world to keep track of this volume of species?
Well, the tomatoes are being hybridised. Well, hybridised is not necessarily the right word. Cross-pollinated, so that there's quite a lot of advancement in different varieties coming onto the market, and it's particularly in America. There's a lot of emphasis on the black tomatoes now, and I've got some seed of that, but that's for next year's sale. But the whole thing is to try and keep the varieties are going. A lot of them self-pollinate so that the seed is quite pure. It's an interesting one because the Botanical Gardens now has a seed vault of about 600 varieties of tomatoes, so that makes it a standout collection now. Over time, we've just been building up and building up, so we've got that many now, which means that we're the envy of a lot of places like Diggers, seed places, very envious of our box of tomato seed these days.
Do you think that when we think about seed diversity, we tend to think of it as a great big global issue, but here we are standing in the Botanical Gardens greenhouse with 200 varieties of tomatoes. It's one way that the community can engage with such an important issue, given that seeds are the basis of our food industry.
Well, that's right. And if you there's so many studies saying how few things are available these days. So this is really a hotbed of diversity. And so many seeds have been lost from the catalogues even since when the Botanical Gardens opened. We were a food provider where they actually were growing a lot of plants here to see if they would do well within the Tasmanian conditions. And all of those varieties, there was something like 30 or 40 different grains that they were experimenting with here in the gardens that have gone. You know, so that's disappointing in itself. But we're trying our bit here. And it actually is the beginnings of people thinking seriously about that sort of thing and turning it around. So it's quite cool.
Margot White from the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens, who's overseeing the, would you believe, 200 different types of tomatoes. They're not actually species. It's all one species, isn't it? But I guess they're cultivars. And they'll be going on sale. And a date for the diary, or if you've got a good memory, is the 18th of October. So that's not this week, but next week. And for early birds, if you're willing to pay a $10 donation, you can get your pick earlier on. And then the sale starts, well, for proper or for the general community on Saturday, October the 20th. 200 different types of tomatoes to take your pick, and it all goes to a good cause given it all is going to the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens. We'll stay tuned to the Country Hour tomorrow. A special broadcast, we're going to be hearing from farmers that are farming in Wesley Vale through to Sassafras, looking at how they've diversified to maintain their farm profitability. It's 1 o'clock now.
We are one.
The ABC channels are good because it's got good shows on it, and yeah.
On air, online, on digital, and on the listen app, this is ABC Radio Hobart.